Welcome to Your New Life Blend. I'm Shoshana Hecht, and I'm so excited for a Your New Life Blend first for our season 3 finale. I have two guests with me today, authors of the upcoming novel, The Memo, Rachel Dodes and Lauren Meckling. Have you ever looked at someone who seems to have it all effortlessly, stylishly, gorgeously, and wondered, what the heck did I miss? That is the premise of The Memo and why it is so very hotly anticipated. The central character, Jenny, finds out that all her fabulous, successful friends did in fact get the memo, and she has the chance to go back in time and change everything. The novel invites us to ask ourselves, would we? It's so good and fun and dishy and comes from a very authentic place because both Rachel and Lauren are successful, celebrated journalists and authors whose work has appeared across numerous outlets, including The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, among many others. Rachel Dodes is also a freelance culture writer and a regular contributor to Vanity Fair. And Lauren Meckling is also a senior editor at The Guardian US and former author of a regular book column at Vogue. Also, Lauren is the creator of the popular Instagram profile, The Clog Life. Clogs are very in my circle of interest. I did indeed receive the clog memo. The memo is on many best of books of 2024 lists, including Vogue's, received a starred Kirkus review, and has already been optioned for TV development. I devoured this book. I read it in a day and a half, and y'all, I am a very, very slow reader. Obviously, the themes explored are extremely Your New Life Blend, and I can't wait to talk with Lauren and Rachel all about all of it. Welcome to the show, Lauren and Rachel.
Thank you, Shoshana, for that amazing introduction. It's so great to be here, and we love this podcast. It's really a delight.
Oh, and I want to hear how you read a book in a day and a half, because I struggle to read a book in a month. So,
Lauren, I am a really slow reader. It's that good. It's that riveting. I mean, I'm telling you, a day and a half. I picked it up 5 p.m. one day and read 2/3 of it that night. I stayed up late, then finished it the next afternoon. It's that good. I love the central question in the memo. What more is possible? It's one of my favorite coaching questions generally. What matters most? How do we spend our time? What makes our lives good and meaningful and also our own? And also, what do we regret? And what did the things we regret make possible? So the themes are super deep and real, speak to having lived some life. So I have to know, how did you come up with the idea?
I will happily start. I can tell you the exact moment when the idea came to be, which was I had my 20th college reunion coming up, and I remember I had been at an eye doctor's appointment in the Upper East Side, and I was at a deli magazine stand and about to get on the subway, and I was looking at all these magazines, and I was at the time an underemployed freelance writer and thinking, I do not want to go to my college reunion. I've not written for any of these magazines, no matter how hard I've been trying to. And I was on the phone with a friend of mine, and I was like, just didn't get the memo. I just don't want to show up and meet all of our friends who were in our history or social studies classes who somehow got these memos, and they're leading these very purposeful and successful lives. And I thought it was a kind of a dark, funny concept. And at the simultaneously, Rachel and I had been igniting our relationship. We had worked together once upon a time when we were in an office where neither of us was allowed to be that funny. So we were both like good workers. We're kind of hot for each other secretly. And then later in our lives, less beholden to an institution, we realized that we had this zany sensibility that we shared. And I called Rachel and I said, do you think this would be a very funny story? And she said, absolutely. And then Rachel helped me map this whole thing out and conceptualize a way that the memo could become this very loopy, trippy, science fiction-ish comedy.
But there was also this other subplot going on having to do with the pandemic, which is that she had written a novel, came on my podcast. We realized we shared this comedic sensibility and decided we had to work on something together. So we came up with a concept for a scripted podcast. Everyone was doing podcasts, and scripted podcasts were like a thing in 2018, 2019. And we had this idea, and we had a meeting with a big podcast company to pitch our idea on March 14th, 2020, I think it was. Like, it was like literally the day the earth stood still. And so that got canceled and we were like waiting to reschedule it. And then the pandemic happened. And then I moved out to Long Island to stay at my parents' house. My husband got very ill and then recovered. And we were like, this meeting is never going to get rescheduled. What are we going to do? So we had had this conversation about not getting the memo. And we were like, let's dig into that. Let's like focus on that and do something together.
Yeah, we had been working on another concept. And then I just feel like we were both increasingly finding ourselves in the territory of women being women who really felt like we didn't get the memo, even though we had had so many opportunities and so much privilege. But here we were, 40-something moms with not much to occupy ourselves. And I think we got frustrated with all of our other attempts. And then we just said, okay, let's just write this fucking thing ourselves. Pardon my French. You can beep that out.
No, we love an E for explicit at Your New Life Blend. So we love to be real. We have no problem with the F-bomb. Okay, there's a few ways I want to go with that, but I just want to touch. Very sick with COVID. One of the things that we talk about a lot on this podcast, when this podcast came out of the pandemic, was like, okay, if you're not going to look at what do you want your life to be like in the face of a 100-year horrific storm where there was a ton of suffering, when will you? And there's a lot of ways that are, a billion ways that our lives can be upended and, you know, we need to reset. A husband being very sick sounds like a real shapeshifter if you want it. Hopefully, I assume he's okay.
He's okay now, yeah. But yes, you're absolutely right. It was a huge wake-up call and a moment to reflect on like life being so short and anything could happen. And what do you want to make of your life at this moment?
That just happened a few days after this meeting and then everything that transpired from that. Yeah. And I remember you did a bunch of writing about that moment. Seemingly purposeful, you said, Lauren. Well, I say seemingly. You said people, all these people, you know, wanting to go with all these people, dreading this purposeful, these people who are living purposeful, intentional lives. And in my head, when you said that, I went, or so it seems. And I think that's one of the themes that comes through the memo, this idea of like, what do we really know? What's gloss and veneer and what's deeper? So do you want to speak a little bit to that?
I think Rachel and I are both, I mean, we're both writers. As I think about this book, I think we just both keep looking at our pasts as having these infinite tendrils or tentacles of possibility. What could we have done between then and now? And then we look to the future and think, well, what could we do between now and the end? Not that we'll ever die, but we will. And I think there was an element of wish fulfillment in writing this book in which we looked at people who inspire envy or frustration in us. And we posited this theory that actually those people are A, unfulfilled, but B, have been given these marching orders that some people do not receive. And it somehow made everything feel more fair and satisfying to look at the world in that way.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit just in terms of, so we just bring listeners up to speed about like really what the twists and turns of the book itself. We can just like bring people into like what the heck we're talking about. Because the book doesn't come out till June, and this is coming out sooner. So, Rachel, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah. So the book centers on Jenny Green, who is 35 on the eve of her 15th college reunion at a small liberal arts college in upstate New York. She really doesn't want to go. She's living with this cheating boyfriend who she met in her early 20s and probably should have broken up with in her early 20s, but just sort of never got the memo on that. And her friends are all killing it. And she's living in Pittsburgh in this like crappy apartment with this guy. And she shows up to the reunion because her friends make her go and discovers what she had always suspected, which is that she did not get the memo and everybody else did. And she reunites with this magical career counselor who offers her the opportunity to undo her worst mistakes and live her life according to the memo that everybody else got. But at what cost?
But at what cost? Oh, yeah, there's so many things in that. Just thinking about Jenny and her boyfriend, Hal, and how there's like so much bad in that relationship, but also like just enough good to keep her like hanging on, right? And I think that's really typical, like that floating a lot piece of it is really, that really spoke to me. Lauren, go ahead.
Yeah. And I know, I think as a woman, as you get older and older, also, if you're on this kind of tricky bad and good relationship, the more the years accrue, the less likely you are to call it a night and move on.
It's like sunk costs, you know? You're like, oh God, I put so much into this. Like, do I really want to like start over? And she's kind of like, I'm attracted to him and the sex is good and what, you know? And she's just kind of like, okay, like it's, I'm just going to go with the flow. And before you know it, she's 35 and doesn't know what is going on with this.
He was a one night / one week stand once upon a time.
A vacation one night stand, yeah.
In a treehouse in Costa Rica. They had a really nice week in that treehouse. And then here we are 10 years later. Not having that nice a time, I would say, according to Jenny, although she probably initially wants to believe things are going to get better. And it's also harder because I think other things in her life are falling apart. So it's maybe easier if you are the CEO of Estee Lauder and you're 34 years old to break up with your boyfriend. But if you have suddenly this junky job in a city where you don't want to live, where you don't really know anyone, and you're just trying, you will hang on to the hot guy who has suddenly become much more attractive than you as the years have moved on.
A city where she moved to and restart, sort of have a reset, escape, and like be a little unencumbered by the comparisons. And then, of course, you know, wherever you go, there you are.
There she is.
There she is. One of the themes that I really loved about it was this: when confronted with the option to have a do-over, reset, to have a life that you think you want, what would you do?
I think it's a really compelling idea to go back and change your worst mistakes. And I don't know if we have an answer of whether it's the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. What we wanted to say is that it comes with trade-offs. Living an everyone's so obsessed with living an optimized life and for maximizing everything and success and this notion of success and living a big life. And there's something almost shameful or frowned upon about not wanting to conquer the world. And Jenny, all she really wants is to have this small life and be a baker. And somehow society has told her that that is not enough. And so she kind of buys into that for a while.
Right. Society and the catastrophes that befall her on that path, right? Which I think are confidence shaking. But I think you're right. Like, the memo does at some point help Jenny connect to what she loves the most. Yeah, go ahead, Lauren.
No, I just think the point you just brought up, I didn't even thought about this bifurcation of what society instills in you that it wants for you and you should want for yourself. But then also these dumb little mistakes that haunt us and that we feel like if only we could scrape them from our personal record. So in this book, Jenny is obsessed with this idea that somehow she has not risen to the level that her colleagues or her classmates did, and that embarrasses her. But also, I'm sure when she wakes up at 3 o'clock in the morning, she's thinking about these little dumb moments. And so this memo doesn't just bring her to this arena of greatness, but it also helps her go to those specific moments and undo them. And then she sees what life would have been like had she not screwed up here and there and elsewhere.
I mean, I relate to that so much. The whole idea of, like, you know, like lying in bed at night, relitigating every dumb mistake, which I wonder, like, is that a uniquely, I mean, I'm much better at it, but like I hear that over and over again from clients and my friends. And I just wonder if that's like a uniquely female experience. This feels like a book that could only be written by women for women. And I wonder if that's just a piece of that too, where, because how many men get like the second, third, 15th chances, and women, a lot of women end up sort of like in this Jenny eroded confidence place. Your heads are nodding. I don't even know who to toss this one to.
I'll just take it from here for a tiny bit, which is that that's something we were definitely thinking about. And as we were working on the book, we really developed that. It turns out that the society that imparts memos to different women is, it's completely women oriented. And we were really playing around with this idea that for very many and sad reasons, it is impossible to be a woman alive at this moment in time and check off all the boxes, right? So the idea that we were really playing around with was that unless magic is on your side, like, you're screwed, right? Or if family money's on your side, there is a little caveat in our memo where women with family money are kind of, they don't get to
Nepo
play
babies.
In sandbox.
Nepos don't get memos.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure, like, you've sort of hinted at this. Like, there's, you know, you two were looking left and right and it was like seeing people who had the memo. Anyone who read this, I mean, for me, I mean, again, read it in a day and a half and devoured it. And I was like, yes, yes. You know, like I see so many people. Anybody who read it was like, nah, I never felt this way.
Yeah. I had one reader who I remember she read it and she said it was built on just a total fallacy, because why would women want a memo? And it made me realize how lucky this one reader was. What was the term she used, Rachel? Was it just a fallacy? Or?
I think fallacy was the word she used.
She said it was predicated on a fallacy that women on planet Earth in 2023, 2024 would want a memo. And this woman is actually killing it. And I will say it broke my heart when she told me that. But at the same time, it made me realize, oh, wait, I have something there. There is something there, because I know so few women who live in the kinds of house that this woman lives in and have the career that she has and the family that she has. So yes, a woman who's killing it by all measures did not relate to this story. And everyone else who has read it, I think it triggered more pain than they were expecting of a commercial summer novel.
Yeah, we did have some like early naysayers for sure. And ultimately we decided it's not going to be for everyone, but is it for anyone? All it takes is one person to love it. And then more people started telling us, yes, we feel this. We just kept going. We followed our intuition on it.
For me, it feels extremely relevant, extremely of the moment. Most people I know feel this way. Like, I did not get the memo. I don't even know what to say. Like, how many times I have wanted someone to be like, just tell me what to do. I will do the steps.
No, I'm just thinking. I used to be more fit and I used to go to yoga. I just remember there used to be like, I mean, you would go to yoga class. The teacher would come and adjust your body in the class. And I just remember thinking, and that was kind of my like, initial like New Yorker shouts and murmurs idea at the time. Like, what if there was a world where you could just have someone not just adjusting your spine and your hamstrings, but just constantly being by your side and whispering, like, don't go into that bodega, go to the chop salad across the street, or don't look at your boss when they offend you, etc. I think that's such a fantasy for all. I mean, I think that's why self-help is so big. I think that's why we're all constantly searching, because we just want the answer. So how great would it be if you just got a literal memo that gave you the answers and you could just move on, go about your day?
Not have to do all the thinking and all the planning. Rachel, go ahead. You were going to chime in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also magnified the feeling of not getting the memo in this world of like performative perfection on social media. There's all these people who seem to have these curated, perfect lives, and you don't realize that in those moments where they're not shooting videos and not posting photos, their husband is sleeping on the couch and they're arguing with their kids and things are pretty awful. And it's almost like inversely related. I've discovered that the more ecstatic people seem on social media and are constantly posting, the darker the underside is to their lives.
And I think also our culture, the way we've like leaned into this culture of algorithms and quantifying everything, and success always comes in numbers now, which I find incredibly dreadful. I think could lead one to feel like, okay, it's much easier to feel like, oh, I guess I am not winning this game because I made something or I worked on something that didn't reach as many people as another project. And I think we're much quicker to take data and use that as the be all and end all.
Yeah, Lauren and I are like old school, like journalists. We feel like a good story will reach people. But now it's like you write something and the editors are like, it performed well or didn't perform well. And like, here are the numbers on the performance, and everything is so data driven.
I have nothing to add to that except that, yes, this new way of looking at things. I do feel, I mean, we're both in our 40s and we've been in the journalism world since we were babies. And we remember a time when that wasn't the way that conversations were held about a story that somebody wanted to bring up as being beautiful and special and remarkable. But now everything is about attention time and how many times something was retweeted, etc.
It is sad. I mean, we could definitely take turns into like the impact that algorithms and siloing stories used to have an opportunity to breathe and marinate and resonate that just takes time. Information is transmitted on all these platforms. It just doesn't allow for that, right?
I mean, it's a bummer that this is like what dictates the way that we're supposed to look at success. But it's also a bummer in the way that it dictates what resources are put into for the next thing and the next thing. Let's say something that's kind of crummy, quote unquote, does well. We might see more and more of things like that. And I just think about there's other kinds of beautiful work that is being done.
That's not being surfaced because these other things are.
It's like a heart twister. Before we went to that very dark place, I think it really is. And again, it does relate back to the book because it's like, because there's so much of that pouring energy into the appearances of what's important. How we define success for ourselves as opposed to having it be on someone else's terms or bury div.
Well, I think that's the hardest thing, especially if you were raised in the kind of family and culture that it's just all about helping you achieve your greatest self and do your best. Rachel and I both had similar experiences, both of our families, where we went into journalism. I'll speak for myself. I will say that my mother was worried about me and tried to encourage me to take, I don't remember the name of it, but there's a test to go into business school. And she, you know, paid for me to take this. The GMAT, yeah. So I studied for the GMAT and then I went to this GMAT test and I had actual my first and maybe last, but definitely my first nervous breakdown while I was taking the test. And I left. I remember getting stuck in the elevator and just needing to get out on the street. Rachel, you can take it from here.
Yeah. My parents were the first in their families to go to college. So there was just a lot of achievement pressure. My dad was a dentist. My mother was a lawyer, still is. My dad's retired. And they thought either medicine or law are like the two like most, they just wanted like security for me. And when I abandoned, I was a biology major. And when I decided I wasn't going to go to medical school, it was like a huge gut punch for them. And I would get these long letters about how journalism and writing, it's just like, this is not a career. And maybe they had a point, but this is very risky and this is really hard. And my response to that was, isn't it hard to go to medical school if you don't want to be there? Isn't that also hard? You just kind of have to follow your own North Star. And it's hard sometimes when you're being told by everyone on the outside that you're doing the wrong thing.
Yeah. And Jenny's in her mid-30s. I do feel like she embodies new difficulty, which is, I think in a way it is easier to be in your teens and then in your early 20s and be pursuing achievements that they're not totally attainable, but they're attainable and you know how to grasp for them. But then I think one of the things we were thinking about with the memo is our character is in her mid-30s, which for all intents and purposes is midlife. She's starting to think about questions such as, what if I don't just want to tick off these boxes. Life is not an infinite experience. How do I want to spend the rest of my time here on Earth? And I went to this great college and okay, I was surrounded by people who are building rocket ships and becoming doctors. I lived with this hot guy who cheats on me. But I think there's this idea that your life is very dramatic when you're in your 20s. And it is. But I think in a way, it's also like more deeply dramatic when you get a little older, because you're actually really having to grapple with, what if I want to do something different that's not on the script that everyone else I know is following?
And the stakes start to feel really high because of time.
You don't have forever, especially for women. We thought 36 is a very critical age. It's kind of like the moment in the memo and in reality when you kind of leap into adulthood and it gets harder and harder to make any significant changes. So she's right on the cusp of turning 36 and thinking about all of these things she did wrong and how she's going to correct her journey for the future.
I really puzzled over the age, but then it really clicked in, especially as she was exploring these, like, maybe I should be freezing my eggs. I can't afford to freeze my eggs. Would I even want that? And everything you're speaking to is very, it's just something I think about in my job all the time, which is like, how do we do this our way and not be frozen in comparison? And also the self-doubt, like just going back to the mistakes, you watch everybody online and everyone seems to be glossy and you wish you had someone saying like, send the newsletter weekly or send it every 2 weeks or get the Substack or don't get the Substack or post this many times. That's the right number. And we do it or we don't do it out of, I think, a lot of fear of like effing it up.
You have to have momentum. If you stop, like the magic flywheel will somehow just disappear and you can't go back.
I think it gets harder. I mean, if you're not, unless you're in grad school for the rest of your life, I will say it is easier to be a people-pleasing type A person. When you're a younger adult, you can make a list of everything you want to achieve and you can go after it and you could probably achieve it with enough all-nighters.
That's right.
And that was something we were grappling with as two women who achieved a lot, I will say. And yet we were looking at each other and saying, where do we go from here? Should we feel smug? Should we feel disappointed? How do we spend the rest of our years and months? But going onward, I think we both felt we were like, we had this itch to scratch of, wait a minute. Okay, we both got front page stories on the Wall Street Journal where we both worked, but here we are. But we didn't feel like we were done with living life.
Yeah, we felt like we were being made invisible during the pandemic, and we wanted to express the emotional truth of what that feels like. And that was through this time travel novel, but I think it's obviously fiction, but I think there is a kernel of truth about what we were feeling while we were stuck in those months of the pandemic.
And I don't think we would have written it's funny when I say I wrote a time travel novel, people are asking me what I know about, you know, the Italian Renaissance or what have you. This is a novel where a character goes back over the course of a decade, right? But I think Rachel and I came up with this as a true salve to the pain that we were going through in the pandemic. We just wanted to get out of our lockdown situations. So it was a true magic carpet ride.
Yeah, transport me out of this hellscape.
Yeah, bring me back to 2009.
Yeah, bring me back.
Yeah.
Let's talk about just the nuts and bolts of writing it together and, you know, mapping out the strands of like where life can take you and the fun of a time travel and how Jenny's open-ended choices can set the timeline off. Like, how did you do it remotely working together during a pandemic? Were you able to get together? Was it all Zoom remote? Did you do it when the family was on top of you? Like, how did it all go? And yeah, and also just like time travel as a genre, and it is so fun.
I mean, I love time travel books, and like, I think Slaughterhouse 5 is my favorite book, I think. And so Lauren and I, we were not in person at all. We were actually located pretty far away from each other during this whole time. And we wrote it together through the magic of shared Google Docs. And we basically had two tracks, like there's the memo track and the regular track. And so we like mapped out the timelines and had an outline of like what was going to happen in each chapter. Because I think with a book like this, you could kind of write yourself into a hole if you don't know exactly where it's going to go in the end. And yeah, like it changed a little bit, but we kind of knew the direction we were headed. And then we'd be like, okay, I'm going to take a crack at chapter one. Oh, I just wrote this funny part. Go back and check it. And like we'd work together and we really trust each other. And we're like, our copy is not like precious. It's like, okay, delete it. If you don't like it, just write over it, change it. We had that kind of trust with each other and we would work asynchronously. Sometimes we'd be in the document together and we'd be writing each other notes. Hi, Lauren, in all caps.
It's always funny when you're on a Google Doc and then you see the avatar. So and you're like, they're there. But then it'd be so fun because Rachel would be there and she would add a joke to a lie that I had written. I will say also, Rachel and I have a very old fashioned hobby, which is talking on the telephone a lot. I would say we talked on the telephone every day. It's like why people go in a writer's room. You just kibitz and you just go through what's working and what's not working. You spitball. And so our outline was sort of firm yet loose in that we knew, okay, well, we're trying to establish these two parallel tracks throughout the book of this woman's life. Were she to have followed her memo and not made mistakes and to show what mistakes she had made. But that was loose. And then we were able to, on a daily basis, run things past each other and try to get each other's blessing or the opposite, which was also very helpful. I really don't know how solo authors do it. I cannot imagine writing a novel where I wasn't did not have Rachel on speed dial. And I know I'm very lucky because I know that she tells me that she doesn't pick up the phone for most people.
I don't take incoming calls.
She doesn't. But she picks up the phone for me every time. And we have a lot of fun goofing around or even just bringing up funny things that happened to us that day that we might incorporate into our book to help us process our real life.
We've talked about this, Lauren and I, before, but it's almost like 95% of the work of writing the novel had nothing to do with the writing. It was just kind of like talking about, oh, my neighbor is so weird, like this weird thing happened, or that person canceled this meeting and I was the only person on the Zoom and it was like just so horrible, and just all these like indignities sort of built up and somehow made their way into the vibe of the novel.
It is so old school to get on the phone and just talk to each other. It's incredible.
I know. No one else takes my calls.
No one else takes. It is 2024 after all. Nobody takes calls.
That's no. You know, Rachel doesn't even do. She doesn't ask for my consent. You just call me.
Oh,
I love that.
Oh, I just call.
You just call.
Do you have?
If we did that, we would never. It would just be like planning about the call and meetings about the meeting.
And then a cancellation of the call on some Google Calendar.
Yeah, well, I mean, with your inner circle, you don't have to, you know. I trust that if my friends can't talk, they won't pick up. So, yeah, I do.
Hilariously, as you're saying this, my work bestie from my office job just called me and I just pressed decline. It's hilarious. But he also, I pick up for him normally.
Listeners who are not like us, I am older. I am 50. I still enjoy a phone call and a connection, but connection call like that and a random call. It's like a thing. It feels good, everybody.
Yeah, listeners, that's my one memo for you. Give it a shot. Call someone today.
It's delightful. It's delightful. Okay, so in the memo before we wrap, because I mean, there's so many twists and turns I could take. I want to just name, like, maybe this percolated up in these phone calls, but you skewer a lot of feminism, girl boss, the patriarchy, I guess, right? The mom, like what it means to be a mom, having it all. What does that mean? So is that really, like, in terms of the process,
Yeah, I think we wanted to, when we created the job that Jenny winds up being in during this phase of her life, we kind of wanted to make fun of this kind of performative feminism that took hold over the past, I don't know, 10 years or so. And so she works in this feminist organization. The role of it is to build up awareness of the gender gap. And
her boss is a raving lunatic billionaire.
Yeah, who won't even pay for like healthcare or for, you know, she wants her to work all the time, but they have no benefits. Like she can't get egg freezing if she wants to delay motherhood so she can focus on working for this organization. And she gets increasingly disillusioned as she realizes that the promise of this job does not match the reality. And I think so many people have had that experience. I certainly have.
Yeah. And I think Rachel and I both, not to be totally dark, but I'm going to be totally dark. I think as we got older, I think something that we both realized was that this whole kind of, I'll say performative feminism, but there is an element that issues a false promise talking to each other. I think we were not feeling fully served by the supposed progress of our society. So we wanted to explore that, the idea that, you know, people can essentially make money off of the idea of putting a hashtag in front
That's of right.
helping women, when in fact, women are still really struggling to sleep at night and not feel like they're messing up during the day.
Yeah. And especially during the pandemic, it was like the burden of monitoring the remote schooling and cooking and taking care of the house fell predominantly on women.
I was working at the time at a company that had a hashtag to do with feminism, and they didn't like that during the pandemic when I had two children who were ages, you know, like 2 and 4. I mean, they were little, and I was Zoom schooling them, and they let me go. I was not able to be on Microsoft team calls all day long. I would tell people I could come to some, but I have to help so-and-so with her math homework. I guess the hypocrisy was just so in my mouth and it tasted so dirty that I could not want to have fun with that.
You're right. Like during the pandemic and being in lockdown, it just revealed what was here, like, so plainly. Mom's doing a lot of jobs, especially handling everything and then taking their Zoom calls in what a few of my clients would call conference room B, which was the bathroom, right?
Yeah. So. I will say friends of mine at my former employer, it's just, we were talking recently and they were saying the few dads who also worked at the company did not lose their jobs, mm-hmm. and they were seen as heroes. Oh, it's so sweet that Josiah is going to be doing, you know, reading homework with his kid, et cetera. And it is sweet. And I would wish that everyone would be able to do that given these extenuating circumstances. But it's just funny that our society was like up ready to celebrate girl power up to a point until it maybe was going to chip in and take away profits.
Okay. On that uplifting note.
It's funny because Rachel, it's just funny that we're getting so dreary because that's not what Rachel and I tend to talk about during our multiple phone calls of the day. So
I think the memo is like a funny version of all of this darkness. And it enabled us to take everything that we were going through and turn it into something that was amusing, but also hopefully resonates with people.
Well, that's comedy always, isn't it? Like the funniest people are the darkest people, period. And also the takeaway of the memo is not dreary at all. It's extremely uplifting. Like ultimately it takes Jenny back to herself, right? It takes Jenny back to the life. It emphasizes like free will. It takes her back to what she feels like her purpose in this life was, where but like the world and society and like the mistakes that eroded her confidence and pulled her off her path. Ultimately what we find is like, no, when you tune in, when you listen to your inner wisdom, when you trust yourself and you effort to not let the powers that be grind you down, then you can find your North Star again. And it's not about money.
Right. That was something that was fun to think about as Jenny moves through the book and where she lands, that she has these like metrics by which she looks at herself and says, oh, am I in the right city, or are my friends the right people, or et cetera. And I think near the end of the book, you know, she does have this awakening, and that's just a fun thing to think about. I think as we all, you know, I just talked on the phone yesterday to another novelist who's older. She's in her 50s and she just left New York City where she's grown up and spent her entire life. She just moved to this town in upstate New York a week ago and she's trying to figure out her life. But I think there is that fantasy, like once you get rid of the fantasy that you've been fed and you've been told that you need to be chasing after, there is this idea of, wait a minute, you actually can write your story and no one else really cares. No one else is going to be that excited if you get a big bonus at the blah, blah, blah company.
Right. It's like dance like no one's watching because literally nobody is. Like
no one's watching.
Go for it. No one's watching.
Myth dispelled number 101, number one, right? Which is we think everyone is paying attention to every little thing that we're doing. And the truth is no. So do the thing that lights you up and makes you feel amazing and do it your way, you know? In alignment with your
Shoshana,
integrity.
What would your memo have told you?
I think my memo would have said, know yourself a little better. Explore yourself, maybe. I think it would have definitely have said, it would have gotten me off the medical school track faster, the pre-med track a lot faster, stuff like that. All the like very ambitious, people-pleasing, shoulding that I did along the way. I'm definitely a recovering people pleaser. And so there was a lot of like...
A lot of shoulds.
A lot of shoulds. And now I like to say, don't should on yourself. So
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to borrow that.
Yeah. No shoulding on yourselves. What about... Okay. Give me your... What would your memo have said as a way to close us out?
I've been struggling with this question because there's so many things. But I think that one of them is that I would have been less judgmental on my friends, about my friends' idiotic partners who they wound up not being with anyway. And it causes rifts in relationships when you tell too much truth about how you feel about someone else's partner. And so I would have just kept those feelings inside and let them figure it out for themselves, which they did.
That's so hard, though.
It's so hard.
It's so hard. Go ahead, Lauren.
I have so many little memos, just things where I realize, oh my gosh, in 1997, I was in the same loft party as Chloe Sevigny, and I should have hung out with her and gotten her number and become her friend. But I also do sometimes feel, I mean, the original inspiration did come from the fact that I had pursued a career in journalism And I was thinking, I wish I'd gotten a memo. This was going to be an ever-constricting, difficult, and painful path. A lot of the people I went to college with went to Hollywood and, in my fantasy, have the best lives. You know, they're writing the scripts for The Simpsons and Bob's Burgers, and I imagine they all have swimming pools. So that would be another superficial memo. It would have been something like, you know, hang out with them and follow them after graduation. But I do feel like, in light of working on this book and thinking about this, the thing that feels the most resonant to me is almost the memo where I don't have the instructions, but just realizing there are better ways to spend your time than the ways you might naturally choose to spend your time. And, you know, I am 46, turning 47, and I am having more and more like deathbed questions in my head, if that makes sense. Like, oh, you were invited to something. I'm trying to make choices where I feel like I will appreciate them in the future, and rather than just like looking out for myself. I mean, if it were up to me, I would just be on my computer working 25 hours a day.
Right. And success and ambition are addictive. And so is Instagram, and all the apps are meant to pull our attention and, you know, include it and work. You know, I always like to say every yes, it's an automatic no. Right. So make.
What does that mean?
It means that every time you say yes to something, you're automatically saying no to something else. So whether it's time with your kids or your beloved or a book or yourself, it's just time is finite. And so like every single time you say yes to anything,
you're shutting off other doors. Yeah.
And so like that intentionality that I think is what you're talking about is like, where do I want to focus my time and energy is important and super and powerful because we don't get time back.
I'm going to use that next time I get invited to something that I don't not want to go to, but I don't want to go to. I'll just say, I would say yes, but that would also be a no. Thanks.
Sure. Go for it. Yeah. Or you could just say, thank you so much. I'm unable to attend.
Oh, right. Fancy that.
Okay.
You don't have to explain.
No, you don't have to explain or defend. You can just politely decline. It's amazing. It's amazing.
That's wild. It's funny. I do have some emails that I have not answered to. And I think that's the reason why. I'm not sure what to say, right. Yes or no.
Yeah. Call me. So my expertise is this, boundaries and firm, polite no's is like, that's one of my favorite. I think I even have a webinar on it. Where can we follow along the success of the memo, which is, we did get a little dreary, but it is a delightful, fizzy, fun, thought-provoking read that I am so excited to share and talk about with all my friends. So where can we follow along with the two of you and the memo and its great success? Lauren, I see you with your mouth ready to go. Toss to you.
My mouth's always ready to go. Yeah. I'm on Instagram at Laurenomics, like Freakonomics, but Lauren. And then I'm on Twitter or X as Lauren Meckling, M-E-C-H-L-I-N-G. I think those are the two places where you can find me talking about memo-related items.
And I'm on Instagram at Rachel Dodes, D-O-D-E-S, all one word, and on Twitter at Rachel D. I'm on Threads as well, which is the same handle as my Instagram.
And we'll post all that in the show notes and, of course, the link to pre-order.
Yeah, and it's out June 18th, which is so exciting because it feels like it's been a long time coming since we've been working on this.
I'm excited for it to be in the world for everyone to read. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you, Shoshana. This was such a delight. Yeah.
Shoshana, really, you're great fun talking to talk to.
Oh, you both are fun to talk to. Thank you. So fun for me. And thanks, everyone, for listening. This has been your New Life Blend. I'm Shoshana Hecht, reminding you forever and ever to be gentle with yourself.